Welcome to Eco Radio KC. Mark Manning joins host Craig Lebeau today to talk about the Kansas City, Kansas Organic Teaching Gardens. Mark is the coordinator of the program, which workshops for students in K through 12th grade. The mission of the program is to connect students with living, breathing gardens on their school grounds and to educate the students on our food supply and nature within our ecosystem. But first, the environmental news for the week of 10/29. There may be a rally around you today. Go to www.youthvgov.org to learn about rallies people are demonstrating on behalf of Children's Trust to have the administration advance Juliana versus U.S., the climate lawsuit. On 10/26, Democracy Now! Reports, the Trump administration announced its approval of a plan to drill for oil off the Alaskan coast. The Department of Interior approved Hilcorp Energy's proposal to drill in the Beaufort Sea, 6 miles off the coast. It would be the first oil and gas production facility in federal waters in Alaska. Hilcorp plans to build a 9-acre artificial island not far from Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Dubbed the Liberty Project, the operation plans to extract about 70,000 barrels of oil per day on the state's north slope. This latest move continues the Trump administration's targeting of the Alaska Arctic. Democracy Now! Reports when Hurricane Michael hit the coast last week, it hit directly on Tyndall Air Force Base. Wind speeds were measured up to 130 miles an hour before the wind speed measuring equipment broke. Afterwards, the base was flattened. Given the storm was sudden, there was not time to fly all aircraft to a safer location. 17 F-22s were damaged, which is worth somewhere around $6 billion. Compare that to replacing the entire base, which would only cost $1.5 billion. By the Air Force estimation, these planes were literally irreplaceable and also just a tremendous cost caused by climate change. Reuters reports the Trump administration unlawfully withdrew a plan to limit the number of whales, turtles, and other marine creatures permitted to be inadvertently killed or harmed by drift gill nets used to catch swordfish off California, a federal judge has ruled. The decision requires U.S. fisheries to take steps to implement a plan to place numerical limits on the bycatch of bottlenose dolphins, 4 whale species, and 4 sea turtle species snared in swordfish gill nets. Pacific Fishery Management Council endorsed the plan in 2015, and it was formally proposed for implementation by the U.S. Commerce Department the following year, but then abruptly withdrawn instead in June of 17 under the Commerce Department under Donald Trump, which determined the cost to commercial fishery industry outweighed conservation benefits. The environmental group Oceana sued, accusing the Commerce Department of violating U.S. fishery laws. Now, U.S. District Judge Gary Klausner has sided with environmentalists in finding the agency's reversal exceeded its authority. Klausner ordered federal fishery managers to either reissue the regs as written or consult with the Fishery Management Council on any review.
Welcome to Eco Radio, and this is 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. And on today's episode of Eco Radio, we have special guest. Tell us about yourself, special guest.
Tell us about myself.
you know this radio gig.
Hi, my name is Mark Manning.
Hey, Mark Manning. Surprise, you're on the radio on a Monday evening. And we have Craig here as our special host this evening. And Craig, what are we going to learn about today on Eco Radio?
Okay, Dave, as you said, our guest is Mark Manning. Mark is the coordinator of the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens initiative over in the Kansas City, Kansas School District. And so we're going to be talking about gardening, organic gardening, and the workshops that he teaches to students from kindergarten up through 12th grade. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you, Craig. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And So let's start with, if you can tell us what the program is.
The program is called the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens, and we started the program in 1990. We created an advisory council in the KCK schools to sort of explore the idea of creating gardens right on the school grounds of four elementary schools that we later expanded to three middle schools. And we worked with parent, teacher-student liaison groups at the schools and principals at schools and teachers. We also had help from the KCK Organic, the Kansas City Community Gardens and K-State Extension Services and people from the Environmental Protection Agency that was located in downtown KCK at that time. And all of them kind of came together. We met on a monthly basis at the school board offices at the public schools headquarters in KCK and kind of came up with objectives with what we wanted to do. And then we launched the program in the year 2000, 2001. We built gardens right on the school grounds of four elementary schools and began developing a curriculum with the garden project. The advisors that worked with us that were members of the Environmental Protection Agency, they gave me really good advice, and they were telling me that if we were going to have this program be successful and have it really involve the students of the schools, we really needed to create a curriculum. Even though our grant money sometimes doesn't provide for that, we went ahead and did it anyway, and I'm really glad that we made that choice because I think it's been one of the strongest parts of our program that we do workshops within classrooms at our schools all through the school year, September through May. The students in the classrooms are directly involved with the garden outside their school. And this year, we're working with 1,250 students at seven schools involving 27 classes of students. And I'm currently doing 49 workshops a month at these different locations. In the elementary schools, we work with the first grade and fourth grade level. And in the middle schools, we work with the sixth grade level. And so at Argentine Middle School and at Rosedale Middle School and at Northwest Middle School, we work with every single sixth grader in the entire school. And so we'll be working with six classes of sixth graders on a Tuesday, come back on a Thursday and work with another six classes of sixth graders or five classes, just depending on how many classes they have at those schools, and involving those students directly into the gardens and into our curriculum that we created. And it's one of the things that we kind of fine-tune each year, kind of keep making it better and keep doing our best to serve the students. But the objective is to get them outside in the garden, planting, harvesting, eating from the garden, taking food home from the garden, and making connections between the science that they're learning in their classrooms and the math and the social studies and the history and the literature and reading and just connecting all those things to the garden and telling those lessons all together.
Okay, and you said in elementary school it's first and third?
First and fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
Okay. When I started, I literally just kind of was going to those places that wanted us and that accepted us. And what teacher wants to do this? Let's just go there. And we worked with a lot of different grade levels. But as we went into the program and as we grew, I made the decision that we would specifically serve first grade, fourth grade, and sixth grade. And that I felt like those grade levels were the most appropriate for our curriculum and that we were able to fulfill part of the benchmarks for their academic learning in those classrooms that were already goals for the school district, we, through the garden, could help achieve those goals and help the teachers with using the garden also for that.
And you made reference to grant. So is this whole program grant-funded, or does the school district fund part of it?
The school district doesn't fund the garden, the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens. We originally got a grant from the Kauffman Foundation, and back in 2000, 2001, we got a considerable grant that helped keep us alive for the first 4 years and helped us build our gardens in the very beginning. And then when we went to build our middle school gardens, we got student grants that were grants that students had to write, and that the people that granted those grants were other students. And that was through the Kauffman Foundation. And that was a really interesting process to mentor middle school students to the point where they could actually write the grant for the program. And we were able to raise money to build our middle school gardens through those grants. And then throughout the 19 years that I've been doing this now, we've had sources from many different types of grants and many different institutions. And we've been supported in part by KU and the Office of Cultural Enhancement and Diversity and the K-12 Initiative at KU. That's kind of an umbrella to us, and also KCK Community College.
Okay. And what are the four elementary and three middle schools that are involved?
Originally, we had four different schools than we currently serve, but we started off with Banneker Elementary, Quindaro Elementary, and Emmy Pearson Elementary. And then we worked with a school called Carruthers Elementary, which has since changed its name. But we, when the market crashed in 2008, 2009, we lost funding for about a year and a half. And I had to actually leave the program and find another job during that time. And when funding came back, I was asked to come back and resume my role with the gardens. And several of the schools had totally gotten rid of their gardens. And we just kind of used that as an opportunity to rebrand ourselves and also maybe make some adjustments and move to a couple other schools that might really need us more than the schools we were serving. So we incorporated a new school, and that was Frank Rushton Elementary. And that's how I met Dave, because at the time that I started there, he was the president of the PTA. And so Dave's wife and son, Charlie, helped build the first garden at Frank Rushton Elementary. And then Frank Rushton was part of a bond program to be completely rebuilt. So they built a brand new school. And in the process, our garden had to become a parking lot. And we were able to build a new garden. And Dave and Charlie came back and helped us build the new garden, right?
Yeah, much later. And there was a lot of volunteers for that.
There's a lot of volunteers.
You do an excellent job coordinating a lot of volunteers.
We had a good thing, because we had like a Monday volunteer day where we had people from the community come in and kind of do a lot of the legwork to make it a little bit easier than for the students to come in and do their part, because we actually had first graders and fourth graders who were involved in helping to build that garden. And so with the help of teachers and community members and high school students that were volunteering after school, and then the students at those schools, because we always want to have the students at the schools to be part of building the gardens that we have. We've learned that when they are a part of building the garden, it's their garden, they own it, and they can say, I helped build that garden. And they may go off and become college students, and that garden still continues, and they've left their legacy at their school for other generations of students to enjoy and take part in. And so it's really, that's one of the things I love about the gardens. It's kind of a cycle of life. Just as you go through the cycle of a garden, you go through all of these cycles of life with students, and there's all these connections that can be made with that. So those are the three elementary schools. The three middle schools, I think I mentioned, were Argentine, Rosedale, and Northwest Middle School. And all of the schools, for the most part, are in the northeast quadrant of KCK, aside from Frank Rushton and Rosedale, which are part of the Rosedale neighborhood.
And you said Argentine, Northwest, and
Rosedale. Okay. Right.
And how was it determined what schools to include?
Well, I work for a woman named Marsha Pomeroy, who I've collaborated with in a number of projects over the years, and she runs a science academy, and she works for KU as part of the initiative that comes out of the Office of Cultural Enhancement and Diversity. She runs a K-12 initiative, and she had been working prior to this with another organization that was doing after-school programming and mentorship. And so she had developed relationships with principals and teachers at a number of schools in KCK, and had basically learned about how so many of those teachers expressed a desire to have a garden at their school. So she just kind of had a list in the back of her head of principals and teachers that had spoken to her about wanting to have a garden program. And so we just approached those schools specifically and said, would you like to do this? And they were like, of course we do. And so that's kind of how it started. It was based on a need and a want of those schools. And that's kind of how we made that decision.
All right. And you mentioned a Monday volunteer day. Is that something that you still have?
We have a Tuesday volunteer day. Tuesday after school, we have high school students from Sumner, Washington, Schlegel, J.C. Harmon, that are students that are part of the K-12 initiative that my boss, Marshall Pomeroy, runs. And they, through their high schools, are required to do so much public volunteering in the community volunteering, and they actually get credit for that. So we keep track of all of their volunteer hours. And in some cases, those volunteer hours can mean that they can get a computer, possibly, a laptop. There can be different things that they can actually get through their volunteer work. And we rely on them a lot. They do a lot of prep work for us for our whole workshop curriculum. For example, last month we harvested over 2,000 pounds of sweet potatoes from all 7 of our gardens. We just had our final harvest last Friday. And so all of those potatoes that have been harvested are all now at Rosedale Middle School. And about 40% of those potatoes are going to be processed for our sweet potato workshops that we're starting this week, where we do a workshop that tells the history of the sweet potato and the whole story of why we grow sweet potatoes agriculturally and how they were introduced into farming by George Washington Carver. And the whole story of the potato in general is a fascinating story to tell, and it connects so many different cultures together. And we make sweet potato French fries in the classroom while we're doing this workshop. And those sweet potato French fries come from the potatoes that we've just harvested. So the students in the schools plant the potatoes. They grow all summer. Then they harvest those potatoes. And then the high school students on Tuesday volunteer night are washing them, peeling them, slicing them, putting them in bags. They get kept refrigerated. And then a few days later, we take them to the particular school where we're doing the sweet potato workshop. So this Friday, I'll be going to Quindaro Elementary and doing sweet potato workshops for all the first grade classes and all the fourth grade classes. And as we're doing this workshop, we're making sweet potato fries right in the front of the class all day long. We'll be doing sweet potato fries for 1,250 students in the next 3 weeks. So it's kind of a marathon of fun. But the high school students help us do a lot of the prep work for those workshops.
And I can tell you right now, I teach those high school students, at least the ones that have been through your program, who've been through Argentina and Rosedale, because I teach in the high school from that school, or from those two schools, and they remember the sweet potato workshops a lot. They talk about it in the biology class that I teach.
Oh, good.
And you're currently working with one of my former students, and she's really excited. She's been wanting to garden for years, and she's been wanting to get more involved. She helped me plant the garden at our school, and
very good.
And now she's working with you. So
yeah, I really think that there's a metaphor about planting a seed. Literally, we're doing that. But also, we're planting a seed inside all of these students' minds. And maybe not all of them are going to go on to grow their own garden. But a lot more of them have more of a reason to do it. And more of a, they've actually seen how to do it. And it's basically, it's just putting a seed in the ground, you know. And we're kind of giving students that opportunity to have a chance to learn about science, not just from a book, but they can actually go outside and they go to high school at J.C. Harmon, and they have a great biology teacher like you, Dave, that helped them take it another step, which is beautiful.
So we're going to take a break, and I believe we've got the news that we'll play now.
Yeah, coming up in just a moment, and we'll get to hear more from the other side of Mark Manning, our listeners might not get to hear as much about in just a few moments.
Okay, we are back with Mark Manning. This is Craig Lubo, and we are talking about the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens. And we will take phone calls if you have a question. The phone number to call is 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. Okay. The question I had is, it sounds like the workshops are incorporated into the regular classrooms as opposed to a regular separate class that they offer.
Exactly. I'm not sure if my mic's on. There we go. We actually come right into the science classrooms of sixth grade science teachers. And schools only have so many rooms in the schools, and they use every single room. Mm-hmm. So getting a separate room can sometimes be a little bit tricky. One of the things that we do is when I work with elementary schools, and I have three different first grade classes and three different fourth grade classes, I will find a room that they can all kind of cue into for that period, for that 45-minute or hour period. It just depends on what school. It's because I have to set up a lot of stuff, like our sweet potato workshop, we have a big table set up where we have a fryer that's actually cooking the sweet potatoes, and then we have plates set out where we actually put those sweet potatoes onto plates and have organic ketchup that we put on the plate and serve these to all the students. We do a lot of eating in our workshops. We have a workshop where we make salsa together. And so we have a big table set up with all these different cutting boards. And some kids are chopping jalapenos. And some kids are squeezing limes. And some kids are taking seeds out of tomatoes. And some kids are measuring salt and pepper. Some kids are setting up chips on plates. And we'll have literally 15 kids working around a table, creating a salsa that we then will get to eat as part of our salsa workshop that we do. So
it sounds like a good group of students that you can have come cater the KKFI party later.
Yeah, right. My background is in theater. You know, people ask me if I'm a master gardener, and I tell them that I'm a theater major, and they always look at me funny. But I come from theater. And if you work in theater, you also end up doing a lot of restaurant work and catering work. And I feel like both of those skills have come into play with my work through the Garden Project. All my catering work and all my theater work has helped me do better at the workshops that we lead.
And since the name of the program includes organic, I'm going to make the assumption, tell me if I'm wrong, that everything you grow there is organic.
Right, exactly. And I like to tell people, I always like to talk to the students about my grandmother, Edna. I come from immigrant farmers who all came into this country in the late 19th century for various reasons, from different European countries, and all of them were poor farmers who homesteaded and lived in dugouts and, you know, whatever they could create for a home to get started. And all of them grew their own food. And back in my grandmother's day, everything was organic. Everything she cooked, all the food she grew, it was all organic. And it wasn't like three times more expensive than the regular food. You know, there wasn't really a marketplace like there is today with grocery stores and everything. It was all organic then. So it's interesting. We just grow our food using organic practices of keeping our soil healthy, composting, rotating our crops, and of course, not using pesticides, herbicides, or fungicides in any of our growing, and trying our best to keep it out of our gardens, although it's hard when everybody else is using it and the wind blows. But that's one of the things. I don't feel comfortable using chemicals when we have first graders, you know, planting and harvesting in our gardens. You can literally go into our gardens and pick peppers and tomatoes and strawberries and beans and food and eat it right out of the garden if you want to. It's safe that way.
And do all of the students in those grades at those schools participate, or is this a optional thing that they sign up for?
Nobody signs up for it. It's part of the program. The teachers are the ones that create the opportunity for their students to be involved in the Garden Project. And I meet with the teachers at the beginning of the school year. And we specifically do this program for sixth graders on the middle school level. Sixth graders are still too early to be a part of like sporting activities after school. Mm-hmm. So it gives them their own thing that other grades levels don't have. It's just for them. Plus the curriculum really matches up with the sixth grade benchmarks in KCK in the school system. And so we just try to involve every sixth grader. And so I've worked to make every teacher want to be involved in this. And we're not, like, forcing anybody to do it. Nobody, if they don't want to be part of this program, they don't have to be. We're only doing it for those that want to be involved. And it's a gift that we bring into the schools. And if other grade levels want to use the garden and involve that, I think that's great. At one of our elementary schools, the art teacher took it upon herself to work with the seventh graders, and they painted signs to go into the gardens. And she was able to keep, you know, not the seventh graders, but the fifth graders, I should say, because the fourth graders had gone through the program, and then she went and used them as fifth graders to keep them involved. At Rosedale Middle School, there's a seventh grade teacher who has done a lot of planting. He got an owl grant, and he's done a lot of planting of fruit trees all around the school. And so he's kind of kept those kids from me working with them as sixth graders, and then he takes them as seventh graders and keeps them outside growing and planting. And they're all involved in composting also. So he's putting all their stuff in our compost pile too. We're trying to keep them from putting branches in our compost pile, but we're working that out.
Okay. And so let's talk about some of the specific workshops that you teach.
Okay. Do we just go through the year kind of for you?
Sure.
We start off with an intro to the garden in September, and we basically take all of the students into the garden and we have a worksheet that we use. They all get a map of the garden and what's growing in their garden. And then there's a list of like 7 or 8 questions on the back that they are required to come up with 5 of the answers. Basically just finding out how many different kinds of plants they could estimate are growing and what plant has the biggest leaf and if they can find plants that have interesting scents or textures. And just getting them out there investigating the garden, because we have a lot of really interesting things for people to discover. And then we have a sea smell touch bed in every one of our gardens where we plant a lot of herbs. We have lemon thyme. When you run your fingers through lemon thyme and then smell your fingers, they smell like lemons. And we have sensitive plants that we plant. When you touch the branch or the leaf, the plant folds up. And we have lamb's ear that feels like a lamb's ear. A lot of herbs have really high value of texture and scent. And just getting them out there, touching and feeling and smelling and using their senses to discover all the things in the garden. And then in October, which we've just finished our workshops for October, we harvest all of our sweet potatoes that have been growing all summer. And that's always really exciting when you have, you know, 25 students out digging up sweet potatoes. It's like they're digging for buried treasure, and it's so exciting. And we do a whole process of weighing all the potatoes too. So we have some students at a table weighing and sorting them out. So we keep track of how many potatoes we're harvesting and how much the weight of all of it is. Last year we dug up a 16-pound potato at our grade school garden at Frank Rushton. It took fourth graders 2 hours to dig it up. And it was the biggest potato I've ever seen. It's not a world record holder by any means. The biggest potato ever harvested was like 67 pounds. But it was really big. And then in November we do our sweet potato workshop where we tell the history.
Let me go back. But yes. You said you harvest the sweet potatoes that were growing through the summer.
Right.
So are there students that come there and take care of the gardens during the summer?
Sometimes. The reason that we switched to growing sweet potatoes as, like, really, I would say maybe 1/4 or 1/3 of all the things that we grow in our garden, sweet potatoes are the largest crop we grow. And the reason that we do that is when we started this program, there were a lot more summer programs in the schools, and different administrations, different presidential administrations, different situations, a lot of funding gets cut, and things that shouldn't be cut, actually, if you want my opinion about it. So all of a sudden we were faced with a situation where, you know, when gardens are growing, the schools aren't really, you know, there's nothing happening at the school. So that's when we decided to plant sweet potatoes, because the students can plant them in May and then go away for the summer and come back, and the sweet potatoes are waiting for them. And they're a kind of crop that's really pretty easy to grow. You don't have to water them too much, depending on the season. They're fairly weed resistant because they get lots of vines growing, so they don't get a lot of weeds. So you have to do a lot of weeding with them. And they're also very beneficial for the soil. So we rotate them around our garden because they keep all of our beds healthy that way. And so we actually started growing sweet potatoes to accommodate a school schedule. And then as we got into the whole story of the sweet potato, we're like, why weren't we always doing this? Because sweet potatoes have so many great lessons attached to them in teaching about the history of them. And so that's what we're doing in the month of November, our sweet potato workshop.
All right.
And then we do worm workshops in December, and then we do seed workshops in January, and then we do workshops about how plants grow, and we talk about photosynthesis and reproduction in the month of February. And then we get back out into the gardens in March and plant spring gardens. And then in April, we do a salsa workshop. And then in May, we do our big harvesting of the spring gardens and planting of the summer gardens.
All right. So we need to take a break now. And when we come back, we'll return with Mark Manning talking about the organic gardening in the schools in Kansas City, Kansas. And we will continue. If you have any questions, we will take phone calls. The number to call is 816-931-5534.
This is federal worker Kenneth Bate of the Social Security Administration, and I encourage all of my federal worker friends to support KKFI 90.1 FM during the combined federal campaign. Donating a few dollars each pay period can help keep community radio on the air in Kansas City. Designate your tax-deductible donation to KKFI CFC Agency Code 21994. Thank you for supporting community radio.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When the temperature rises, you get sweaty and sticky, but hot weather can harm more than your comfort. During a heat wave, even healthy young adults can lose their ability to think at their best. Jose Guillermo Cedeño Laron of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health studied 44 Boston-area college students. Some of the students lived in air-conditioned dorms, and some did not. Each morning, he tested the students' cognitive speed and working memory, and he found that as it got hotter, the students without AC fared worse on the tests.
The reaction times of the students without air conditioning were about 13% longer. The number of correct answers per minute was also lower.
By reducing cognitive performance, he can harm productivity, and not just in schools, but among workers too. Controlling inside temperatures can help.
Between 72 to 73 degrees Fahrenheit, there is an optimum for cognitive performance.
But running the AC contributes to climate change, which ultimately means more heat waves. So Cedeño Laron says we need to develop more sustainable ways to keep buildings cool. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, we are back with Mark Manning talking about the KCK organic gardens in the schools. And again, we will take phone calls. The number is 816-931-5534. Okay, so let's start with, we went through the last group kind of fast. What comes in November?
So in November, we do our sweet potato workshop, which is, by the way, if you're ever on YouTube, you can go to Sweet Potato Wrap. A while back, some UMKC students did a play about food in KCK, and they came out and watched us do our workshop, and they wrote it into this play that they were doing, and they did the whole scene as a wrap, where the teacher called Mr. Manning, quote-unquote, comes into the room, and they took our whole workshop and put it into like a three-minute rap song, which I love. The workshop itself basically tells the story of sweet potatoes and how they're beneficial to our bodies and also to our soil and why we grow them and kind of the whole story of potatoes in general, which is a really fascinating story. And then we make sweet potato fries, like I said. In December, we do a workshop about worms where we bring live worms into the classrooms. And I raise worms in my basement, in my worm bins. And anybody can do it, and that's kind of the whole point of the workshop, teaching people about creating your own worm bin to recycle your kitchen waste and create the most incredible fertilizer you'll ever put in your houseplants or your garden. And you can also sell it, make money from it. You can become a worm farmer. And make,
we're talking about composting.
Yeah, we call the substance that comes out of the tail end of a worm castings because it's so valuable. And like a big bag of castings, you could sell for $40, you know, and you made it from stuff you were going to throw away. So you've actually turned your trash into money. Kids are always really fascinated by things like that. Like, how did that happen? And also, castings don't smell bad. They're actually like really fertile soil. Charles Darwin said that all the fertile soil of our planet has at one time passed through the body of a worm. And, you know, without worms in your garden's not healthy. And so we kind of try to give a workshop that salutes worms and gives them what they do. They deserve a lot of credit for the work that they do outside all the time, creating fertile areas for us to plant our seeds. They've been recycling for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and we're just now catching on to it as humans. So I always ask the question, what's more important to the planet, people or worms? And the answer is worms are more important. Teach the students about all the different parts of worms' bodies, and that worms are that they have five hearts. I don't know if you, did you know that, Craig?
No.
They have five hearts. And a question for you. Do you know how to tell a boy worm from a girl worm?
No, I don't.
Well, worms are both boy and girl at the same time. And that always blows the mind of people that don't know that. But worms, when they mate, they both become pregnant. And they both lay eggs. And worms hatch from eggs that come from a cocoon that comes from the worm's body. And I always love to kind of blow kids' minds because you get all kinds of reactions when you talk about that. And then we bring in live worms, and the kids are able to, like, look at them and hold them in their hands and maybe have a new appreciation of worms. And then we make a worm dessert also in the classroom. The kids actually, while the whole workshop's going on, there's a group of kids at another table making a worm dessert that then they serve to the rest of the school, the classroom.
This is something they eat.
Yeah, this is a very common dessert item that's made out of chocolate pudding and crushed up Oreo cookies and a gummy worm in a cup, and it's chocolatey. It's not. It resembles a compost bin, but it's actually made out of pudding and cookies. And it gives them a little snack. We try to involve as many of the senses as we can with every workshop that we do, like feeling, smelling, tasting, touching. As many senses as you can involve in the lesson plan, the more they'll retain that information, and it'll make more of an impression inside their brains. And that's true with everybody. If we use more of our senses while we're teaching about things, someone's describing food to you while you're eating it, you remember it better than if you weren't actually eating that food while they were talking about it. So it's just how our brains work. And then, like I said, in January, we talk about seeds, and we open up a seed to find the three main parts of the seed. We kind of dissect seeds and find those three parts. And then we use peanuts. I bring peanuts into schools. I know that's revolutionary, right? But I bring peanuts into schools. And I worked with like thousands of students, and there's like one or two out of a thousand. Oh, okay, maybe five or six out of a thousand that are allergic to peanuts. But we try to work around that. But we make peanut butter out of those peanuts with a grinder in the classroom. And then we serve peanut butter on crackers. And then we bring in different items from the grocery store that they are the parts of the plant. Carrots are roots, celery is a stem, broccoli is a flower, lettuce is a leaf, tomatoes a fruit. And we have these items chopped up into smaller pieces, and we have the kids make plant part art out of all of these items. And it gives them a chance to kind of play with food, and then they can eat it too. And it's very healthy for them. And at the same time, they're learning that these things are the parts of the plant. And then in February, we go more in depth on this, and we talk more about what the leaf does and more about what the flower does, how plants reproduce with the flower with the help of pollinators like bees and butterflies. And how the leaf is the part of the plant that conducts photosynthesis, and we do discussion of photosynthesis. And then, like I said, in March, we go out to the garden and plant spring gardens, plants that like to grow in the cooler weather. And then we do our salsa workshop in April, which is a really fun workshop to do, where we teach that salsa is a music, a dance, and a sauce. And we make salsa, and we also dance. We do a dance in that workshop. And then in May, we plant all of our summer gardens. We harvest our spring gardens. Kids take home bags of lettuce, radish, and spinach, and then we plant our summer gardens. And we've given away food anywhere between $8,000 and $10,000 worth of food every year with a garden project that's just been given back into the community.
All right. And I believe we have a caller on the line. Is that right, Dave?
I believe so.
Okay. Caller, could you state your first name and where you're calling from?
Hello? You still on the line, Colin?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, you're on.
What's
the
your
air.
First name?
It's a pleasure to talk to Mark Murphy there. I tell you, he's a real scholar.
Mike Murphy's not here tonight.
Yeah. Listen, Mr. Mark, do you know a safe way to keep deers out of gardens? I'll listen off the air. Keep
okay,
going.
Thank you. Thank you. That's our friend Jim the Blank Guy, who is a very big listener of KKFI. I have had all kinds of problems with deer at one of our gardens. We have deer that come in and eat the sweet potato vines. And this year they got really... There was a drought this summer, so deer were looking for food in all kinds of places and being very aggressive about it. So I've used cayenne pepper. I've used... There's like four or five different kinds of organic deer be gone products that are made out of like... ground up deer meat and deer blood and cloves and all kinds of spicy things that deers don't like to smell. But I was working at one of our middle school gardens, and there was a whole construction crew resurfacing the front of Rosedale Middle School. And one of the construction workers told me that if you put a bar of Ivory soap in the bed, that'll do the trick. And so that's what I did. And it's so much more economical because I was spending hundreds of dollars. This deer be gone stuff is so expensive, and it usually only is good for one or two applications, and then it rains. So a bar of Ivory soap placed in each bed kept the deer out for the rest of the summer. And I didn't know that. It's a new one for me. How about you, Dave?
Yeah, I got a farmer friend who found the same. He'd been working on fencing and doing all these different things, and the Ivory soap just did it like nothing. It smells like humans, they say.
Yeah, the deer don't like the smell of it, and they smell everything first. And these deer were so aggressive this summer. I mean, literally mowing down. Like, we actually probably could have gotten another 100 pounds of potatoes had they not mowed down our leaves in the middle of July, and those plants had to grow back those leaves, and it just set them back a little bit. We probably could have had another 100 pounds of potatoes had those deer not done that at that garden.
So the Ivory soap, though, does that doesn't melt and contaminate the gardens?
Good question. I don't know how organic that is, actually, but it doesn't melt as much as you think it will. But if you left it in there, like what I was doing was whenever it would start to rain, I would take the bar of soap out. Okay. And then after the rainstorm was over, I'd put it back in. That's what I would be doing.
And you mentioned three times, you did fall gardens, you got the spring gardens and summer gardens.
Exactly.
What are the differences between what you grow at each of those times?
The spring gardens and the fall gardens are the same things. We plant the same things. We plant different varieties of radish and different varieties of spinach and different varieties of lettuce in our fall and spring gardens. And radish can take 22 days to grow, where the spinach is more like 44 days, and the lettuce can be 41 to 44 days, depending on the variety.